Okay, let's make a start. I'd like to speak about a fascinating topic that actually brings two very important halachic hashgafic discussions together. And in this way, it makes it, I think, even more interesting because it sees how they, we'll see how they interact. These two issues are the general question about hair covering, head covering, how the whole thing works, which I think is often a little bit misunderstood in how that works. And also the question of the kala. When is a kala a kala? Sounds like the beginning of a joke, but it's not. Like, when? At what point do we say that she is a kala? How does that impact on her head covering, hair covering? We all know there are different minhagim as to what the kalas do. Hopefully, if we see both of these topics and really understand them well, we'll see how they come together. That's why it's a little bit too much for one session. What I've done is I've divided it into two. Today, what I'd like to look at is the general sugya, the general discussion about head covering and how that works for married women. And next time I'd like to dovetail that, if you like, into the whole discussion about the kala, which will be, please God, on our minds, because the end of next week my daughter hopefully will be getting married, please God, and therefore marriage is on the mind. Now, let's have a look here at the source sheet, source number one. Why is it that there is a halachic concept of women covering their hair? Or is it married women, or is it all women? We'll see how that works now. The beginning point on this discussion is the sota. The sota, of course, is a married woman, by definition, who has got herself into a compromising situation of her own choice, it must be said. Meaning she was warned not to lock herself away in the house with a man who she was suspected of having an affair with, and irrespective of that, she chose consciously to do that in front of witnesses, and they were locked up together in the house, but nobody knows what went on inside the house. So on the one hand, she is a guilty party to some degree in that she's done X, Y, and Z, but we don't know what else has happened. Now, I'm not getting into a whole discussion today about the morality of how the sota acted and how we deal with her, etc. That's a separate discussion. We can save that for Parshas Naso if we have a Parshas here on that. But what's interesting for our purposes is it talks about her in doing something, the Kohen doing something to her head. Let's have a look what it says. Number one, the Ha'imid HaKohen et HaIsha lifnei Hashem. They'll stand this woman in front of God. And here's these four difficult words. Ufara et Rosh HaIsha. And they will fara, whatever fara means, the head of the woman. Now, it doesn't say anything about her hair directly, although usually on the head is some hair, okay? Not in my case necessarily, but in most of these married women's cases, that's the case. He does something to her hair, fara. What is this thing that he does to her hair? Look at Rashi immediately on the pasuk. Rashi's understanding is number two as follows. He says two things. Soter et kliyat sa'ara. He messes up. He unbraids the braids of her hair. Okay? Kedei livzota, in order to embarrass her publicly. Umikan, from there, says Rashi, levnot Yisrael shagalu rosh genai lehem. From here we learn that to have your head uncovered is an insult for a Jewish woman. How is he putting the two together? Where does he connect the two? On the one hand, he unbraids her braids, it seems. On the other hand, we've started talking about head covering. Where do we get that from? So Rashi has a similar position. If you look elsewhere in number three, on the issue of the golden calf, when the people are behaving badly at the golden calf, look at what he says in number three. He says as follows. Vayar Moshe et ha'am. Moshe saw the people. Ki parua hu. The same word, parua. They were parua. Ki faroa aharon lishimtza bekameha. They were parua because Aaron had, if you like, done this thing. He'd uncovered, or in some way, brought out their disgrace in front of them. Rashi says parua means megula. It was uncovered. Nitgalashimtza bekolono kamo ufara et rosh ha'isha. Rashi clearly understands the word ufara means, in some sense, to cover. So it seems to have a double meaning. We'll see how this is learnt out from Chazal. It seems to be something to do with undoing her hair and also uncovering her head, and we'll see how that works. Rashi on the Gemara in number 4, Rashi has an interesting derivation. How do we know that this is a mitzvah? It doesn't say anywhere, thou shalt not this or thou shalt that. We learn it out from the Parsha. Rashi explains how it works, how the limud works in Sota. Look at number four. Mida'avinu lahachi l'nevla. From the fact that we are doing whatever we're doing to her, unbraiding her hair, uncovering her head, in order to insult her, that's how we're dealing with the Sota. Mida keneged mida, as a mida keneged mida for what she did, we undo. I'm not getting into a discussion about how that works in the Sota now. Just like she dressed herself up and made herself look beautiful to have, potentially to have this affair with this man who was not her husband. Since we do that to her, to uncover her hair, michlal da'osa, that implies that for a normal person that's osa. That's the first way he learns it. Meaning the fact that we do something to publicly show the indignity of the woman implies that the opposite is the dignity of the woman. That's the first thing he says. Inami, alternatively, he makes a very logical derivation. He says, midich sivu fara, since it says you uncover the hair, or unbraid the hair, whatever that is, we'll see soon. Michlal, that implies, tahahu shaita la paruhu. It implies that at that time, the hair was not uncovered, meaning, if the hair was already uncovered, what have we got to do? The fact that he had to uncover it shows you that the hair was covered. Okay, shma mina, we learn from this, ein derech benot Yisrael, and again, we keep saying Benot Yisrael. It's not necessarily married women. We'll see how that works. You see from here that the derech, the general manner of Benot Yisrael, was never latzeit pruot rosh, to go out with their head uncovered, v'chein ikan. He prefers that. Meaning, whichever way you learn it from the Sota, either we are doing something which is publicly indignity, which proves that the opposite is public dignity, or that the fact that we have to uncover our hair implies that the hair was already covered. Either way, says Rashi, this is a limud learnt out to what he calls Benot Yisrael. We'll see where he's getting this from, that somehow or other something has to be done up or covered when they're in public. Now, it's important to remember a couple of things. First of all, one of the themes running through, leaving aside the technicality of what he's uncovering, whether it's unbraiding the hair or uncovering the head, there is a clear theme running here of dignity. It's not just some random decontextualized halacha of head covering. It's something to do with dignity. Let me ask you a question. What if somebody were to say, I want to cover every hair on my head, I'm going to walk out with a black garbage bag on my head? Okay. Is that fulfilling the din of the Sota, the opposite of the Sota? And the answer is no, it doesn't seem to be. There seems to be something which is, there's an underlying reason here of the dignity of the person here, which takes us into a topic which I'm not getting into, which is the general issue of tzniut, which is a bit of a hot topic, and I think, and I've given you a footnote here, I think a much misunderstood topic. Tzniut is a whole discussion in and of itself. I have, if you're interested, if you're not, then that's also fine, but if you're interested, I have a series of shirim on the website, you can easily find it, 3 shirim on the underlying structure of in the halacha of what tzniut is and what tzniut isn't, because I think a lot of people learn this in a very inappropriate way, but the two are clearly tied together in some way. There is a public dignity about her covering her hair, whatever that covering is, in addition to the technicality of exactly what we're doing. The chazal that Rashi is drawing from are number 5 and 6, and then we'll move into the next and more difficult part of it, which is the Tosefta here. Look at number 5. He pierced a loy sadin. Okay, it says this is all part of the midah keneged midah. She laid out this beautiful sheet to prepare herself for the adulterer. Lekach, therefore, kohen notel kippah mi'al rosha. The only people wearing kippot in those days were the married women, it seems. So he takes the kippah from off her head, umenicha tachet ragla, and he puts it at his feet as a midah keneged midah. He kola'ah lo sarah, she braided up her hair beautifully for the adulterer, lefikach kohen sotro. This is where Rashi is getting it from. Chazal in the Tosefta understand 2 different things are going on here. One is the uncovering of the hair, and one is the unbraiding of the braid. Why am I stressing this? Because when we get to this issue of the kala, and we'll talk about what the kala is doing or isn't doing, we need to understand exactly how this is working. So too, if you look finally, the final installment, if you like, on this part, in number 6 at the top of the next page, the Chazal in the Sifra, in the Halachic Midrash, says, Ufara et Rosh HaIsha, the last one there, Limed el Benot Yisrael. This is teaching us for the Benot Yisrael, again, it just says Jewish women, Shehem Chosot Roshehem, that they have to cover their hair, Afal pisha en raya ledavan. He says, even though I can't bring you a direct proof in a posse that says you must do this or you mustn't do that, says Chazal, he brings you a zeichel ledavan. There is a zeichel ledavan. Where does he bring it from? An unusual situation. But tikach tamar efer rusha al rusha. Afar efer al rusha. You see, the tamar took a, what is this thing, an afar on her head? So it could be efer, it could be ashes on her. She was in, what had just happened to Tamar? She'd just been raped by Amnon. The question is, what is it that she put on her head? And according to Chazal, it seems here that it was some kind of a covering she put on her head. Why? This actually raises the fascinating question, which we're not getting into now, but is this anything to do with married women or not married women, or is it just to do with the fact that the woman has had some kind of a relationship with a man? Tamar clearly was not married to Amnon, and yet somehow or other, she was required to put something on her head, or she put something on her head in that sense. And we'll see more about that as we get into the whole issue of the kala, and whether the consummation of the marriage has got anything to do with it, or not anything to do with it. So, part one, if you like, is this issue of the sotah. The sotah is a married woman, and she's in public. That's absolutely clear. Even though it keeps talking about Benot Yisrael, Benot Yisrael, the sotah, by definition, was married. And we'll see how that plays in. And by definition, whatever we did to her was in public, not in private. It was Lifnei Hashem. It was right in the middle of the Bet Mikdash. So from here, there is a limud from the Torah, and we'll see how Chazal understood it, that there is some kind of a din of covering for or doing up for married women in public. We'll see how that works. What makes this, I think, even more interesting is that there's a second tier to this, which is what we call Dat Yehudit. Now, Dat Yehudit, what does Dat Yehudit mean? That's often associated with Tzniut. What do the words Dat Yehudit mean? So a lot of people, the first mistake people say is it's Da'at, meaning knowledge. It's not Da'at, it's Dat. What's Dat? It's law, practice, okay? Dat Yehudit is Jewish practice. What is Dat Yehudit? So let's have a look now, and we'll see how that comes in, because this will also apply to the kala, and it may be the reason why in many communities the kala does not cover a hair. More of that next week. But have a look in number 7, please. The Gemara, the Mishnah rather, in Ksuvos, is dealing with this issue of the ketubah. The woman, as you know, is entitled to a ketubah if the husband divorces her or dies. However, there are certain things during a marriage that a woman could do in order to lose her ketubah. It works both ways. There's certain bad behavior on the part of the man where the halacha says, I'm sorry, you've behaved atrociously, you have to allow your wife to divorce and give her financial settlement. And there's certain bad behavior on the part of the woman, in which case we say to her, I'm sorry, you've behaved atrociously, and you have to be divorced and you may lose your financial settlement. That's more of that another time. But have a look in number 7. Elu yotzot velo ketubah. The following list of women leave the marriage and they lose their ketubah. Now, what is that list? Ha'overet al dat Moshe v'yehudit. Someone who breaches dat Moshe and someone who breaches dat Yehudit. So what's dat Moshe and what's dat Yehudit? So the Mishnah says, Ezo dat Moshe. What is dat Moshe? So the examples he gives are all examples of where she is breaking the Torah law and doing something that undermines their marriage by tricking him in a way that's breaking the Torah law. Example, ma'achalito she'enu mu'utzah. She's giving him food which has not been properly tied, meaning she's feeding him trade food and she's not telling him. U'mishmashtoi nida. She is pretending, she's telling him she's going to the mikveh, but she's not going to the mikveh, and she is in that sense misleading him. V'lo kotza lo chala. And she's not taking chala from the bread, and she's telling him she is. And she's making vows and she's not keeping those vows. This is all examples of Dat Moshe. What is Dat Yehudit, says the Mishnah? And the first example he gives is Yotzah V'Roshah Perua. She goes out with her hair Perua, with her head Perua, the head uncovered, let's say. Now that's interesting, because Dat Yehudit, didn't we learn that out from the Sotah? We just had this whole discussion that we learned that out from the Sotah. Why is that included in our list of Dat Yehudit? Surely that should be included in our list of Dat Moshe. And that is the very question the Gemara asked in number 8. Says the Gemara in number 8. The Ezu Dat Yehudit. What is Dat Yehudit? And by the way, the other examples which I didn't bring of Dat Yehudit are all examples of her behaving in a publicly flirty or inappropriate way. She's chatting up all the young men, or she's behaving in whatever public way which is unbecoming. Okay, so the Gemara says it raises the question of the head. Ezo dat Yehudit. Yotza v'rosha perua. She goes out with her head uncovered. So the Gemara has a big problem with this. Rosha perua doraita hi. Why are you listing that in Das Yehudit? Isn't rosha perua part of the Torah law? This should be included in the list of other things which she is breaking on a Torah level. Dichtiv, as it says, uforeit rosha isha, and you uncover the head of the woman. Utana de Bei Rabbi Yishmael, don't we learn out that this law from Sotah is azhara? Azhara is a word for an isur doraita. Livnot Yisrael, for Jewish women, shelo yatu paruva paruva rosh, and they're not allowed to go out with their hair uncovered. So the Gemara now explains, and this will get us into more details in the study. No. It says, doraita kalta shapirdom. On a doraita level, it will be sufficient for her to wear a kalta. What's a kalta? Some kind of a net or a bag. I wish I could show you the photo. I once went to IKEA. You may think this is not related at all. I've been many times to IKEA. It's always a stressful experience, but that's a separate issue. I once went to IKEA with my daughter shopping, and we found one of these net bags. And I said, "Oh, Yael, put this on your head now." So she's looking at me as though I was crazy. She put it on her head. I said, "Oh, that's probably very like what a kalta was, some kind of bag. It covered her head, but not very well, and the hair was sticking out here and sticking out there, and it looks a bit of a mess. I've got it. If you want to see a photo later, I can show you. I can't guarantee that's exactly what a kalta was. Something like that. Not a normal head covering, but something which more or less covers, yes. It seems to mean two things. Rashi said it meant both. Wild, meaning what is normally tied up, has been let loose. That's what he did to the soda. And he also says it's a lotion of megula, it's uncovered. Meaning we saw both things in Chazal in the Tosefta. It says she had a kippah on her head, which was removed, and she had braids in her hair, which were made wild. It seems to be both of those things. Chazal are learning both of those things. So the Gemara says no. A kalta would be okay on the Doraisa level, okay? But Das Yehudit, we'll talk a little bit more about what Das Yehudit is. Das Yehudit is afilu kalta nami osa. The kalta is no good. Meaning, there is head covering which is Das Moshe. Okay, that's the basic halakha. But then there's another level. You may be covering enough to satisfy the Das Moshe, but it may not satisfy the Das Yehudit. The Das Yehudit goes further. We'll define what Das Yehudit is in a minute. So now the Gemara raises the question on this. On the third line, number 8. Amarav Asi Amarav Yochanan. Kalta ein bo mishum prua rosh. But don't we have a statement elsewhere that a kalta is fine? There's nothing wrong with a kalta. Nothing wrong with Das Moshe, nothing wrong with Das Yehudit, it's fine. Behevi bi Rabbi Zera heichan. Rabbi Zera asked, where can this be? Where is a kalta fine? Ilema bashuk, if you say bashuk. Now when he uses the word bashuk, it means in the total public thoroughfare, out there in the middle of the public road, where everybody's walking around. If you say he's talking about bashuk, Das Yehudit, we just learned, that's no good. A kalta in the shuk is no good. There's a Das Yehudit which requires her to wear something better. The Elab Chatzer, maybe it's in the Chatzer. Now, where is the Chatzer? Right. Now, is a Chatzer the same as a Bayit?
No.
No. But close. Meaning, a Bayit, we'll see later, a Bayit is a private area. A Chatzer is a private-ish area, but people walk in and out, not necessarily invited. Okay, if you imagine how the houses worked in those days, you had individual houses around a public courtyard. Imagine today living in a building and there are the kind of the stairwell and the common parts. Meaning, usually it's just you there, but occasionally people walk in. He says, in the chatzer, in Cain, if you're telling me she has to wear a kalta, look at the loshon, very interesting. Lo hanachta batla Avraham Avinu sheyoshevet tachat bala. You're never going to have a Jewish woman who can remain married to her husband. Why? If you're telling a woman that every time she's in the chatzah she has to wear a kalta on her head, no one's going to be able to cope with that. You can't walk around with something on your head inside a chatzah. Surely she doesn't have to wear a kalta inside a chatzah. So Amar Abaya, Abaya says, Vitemer Rav Kahana, you're right. It's in a halfway between the two. Michatzer lechatzer, v'derech mavui. It's between one chatzah and another chatzah through an alleyway. Rashi explains what that is. The loishchichi rabim, you don't find the public there very often. So it seems we have three kinds of places, and we have to get this right, because again, when we talk about the kala, we'll have to work out how this fits in with the kala. There are three areas. There's the shuk. In the shuk, it seems that the woman has to wear some kind of a head covering, which is kalta plus. Not just a kalta. Kalta is enough for Dat Moshe, but not enough for Dat Yudit. in the private chatzer, which is not totally private, but is more or less private. She doesn't have to wear a kalta. And in the in-between, like, alleyway area, she has a kalta, it's fine. Now, I don't know what the modern equivalent of a kalta is. When I'm talking to a teenage audience, I sometimes suggest it might be something like a hoodie. I don't know if you guys know what a hoodie is. But like a cardigan thing you throw over your head. Meaning the kind of thing that covers your head, but you wouldn't necessarily go to go out on the bus wearing it. Yes.
To a synagogue I went to in New York, women wore lace
covers. Right. Interesting. As a
married women.
Yes, the married women, obviously. We'll get to single women in a minute. Now, let's talk about dasi hudit. Dasi hudit is a much maligned and misunderstood topic. Very often, dasi hudit is equated with sniyot. The Rambam and Rashi say dasi hudit equals sniyot, sniyot equals dasi hudit. Look at one line in Rashi number 9. There's a lot to say about this. You can get it more from the shirim I mentioned before on the website. Number 9, Rashi says, dasi hudit, shenahagu benot Yisrael, is the minhag, this word minhag, very important, of benot Yisrael, afa gav de loy ketiva, even though it is not written down anywhere. Meaning, Chazal did a very sophisticated thing. And they said, look, we cannot possibly give every community in the world for all time the rules as to what they consider to be tanua. It's not a rule book that falls down from Shemaim. It's not like Hilchot Kashrut. Okay? What we're going to say is there are some basic objective criteria, the Perua Rosh for the married woman, etc., and others which we're not getting into now. But then it's up to the Benot Yisrael in each community to work out for themselves what they consider to be appropriate and inappropriate behavior. And that could be in terms of dress, that could be in terms of other things. For example, many people get very excited about, well, where do all these rules come from about colors and styles and shaitels, this long are okay and that long are not okay. And people produce books with these rules in them. And the answer is, these rules don't come from books. They should, or they shouldn't come from books, they should come from the communities themselves who decide for themselves what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And it should be the women of those communities, not the rabbis of those communities, who are doing this. And this can affect all areas. I remember there was a discussion recently in England where it came out that many women in the Bells community do not drive. And it's considered to be inappropriate for them to drive. Okay? There was a big brouhaha on the radio about this, and there were people interviewed, etc., and everyone, for some reason, got very upset with the women of Bells for not being allowed to drive, or with the men of Bells for not allowing them to drive, or whatever. And I heard people on the radio who should really know about these things saying there is no source, there is no makor, there is nowhere, anywhere in the halachic system that justifies saying that women should not drive. And the answer is, that's your hudit. It's up to them, meaning if the women of that community decide that it's not appropriate for them to drive, then who are you to tell them that their minhag is inappropriate? You can't argue with a minhag. No, you can ask whether the women of the community are choosing or being told what to do. That's a good question. Okay? And at the point at which it becomes imposition of rules on women which they don't want, that's clearly not what dasi hudit is meant to be. But in principle, people can decide for themselves in that way. I have a little a personal story. My wife, many years ago when we were living in London, phoned up the rav of a prominent rav of one of the local shuls because she was getting a hard time. I'm not getting into all the details, but she had a skirt which had a slit in the bottom. This was a time when everyone was getting very excited about that particular issue. So she called the rav and she said to him, is there anything wrong with wearing a skirt which has a slit below the knee in the bottom? And he said, no, people have got to be able to walk. You can't walk around like a penguin. But you have to be able to walk. A week or two later, a letter came round from the Rebbetzin of that community to all the women of the community saying, the women in our community do not accept slits below the knee. Okay, that's interesting. I said to Sarah at the time, it's very interesting. It's a little bit irritating that you're getting different answers, but this is a halach in action. Meaning, really, the Rav is giving a general psak. Yes, that makes sense. And the women of the community are deciding what the dasi hudit is. And at the end of the day, as with all these things, if you don't like it, then I suppose you have to leave and join a different community where you do like it. Now, the truth is, it's not always so clear-cut. And communities are very hard to define today. It used to be, the people in Pinsk lived in Pinsk, and the people in Minsk lived in Minsk, and the people in Dvinsk lived in Dvinsk. And, none of them ever went anywhere else. Now it's not like that. Now it's not about geography. It's more about if you were a card-carrying member of the whatever community, what would that be? And is there a Dati Hudit? Maybe there isn't a Dati Hudit. Maybe the community has no interest really in what color kind of this or that. That's fine. But Dati Hudit is very important as well. And therefore, when we get to the issue of the color, it may depend on the community. There are communities in which there is a Dati Hudit to do X, Y, and Z, and therefore she's going to have to decide whether that's her community or not. By the way, Dati Hudit is not only about women. It's clear that Dati Hudit relates to men's behavior as well. There are clear norms of behavior in different communities. Let me ask you a question. Is it tsanua for the rov of the community to go jogging in the park in sweatpants? Meaning in some communities that will be an outrage. It will be an outrage. It's completely inappropriate, undignified behavior by the rov in public. Can you imagine in some communities around here, the rov's going to go jogging? In some communities, it's eze kavod. The rov goes jogging every morning. It's like the rov's an example that we should all be jogging every morning in the park. And therefore, it's really an issue of Dati Hudit. I remember when I was in yeshiva, I was in an Israeli Haredi yeshiva, there was always a discussion whether it was tanua for the boys to wear short sleeves or they have to wear long sleeves. There was always a machlokes in Yerushalayim and Bnei Brak. It's not just a question of women, and that is again Dati Hudit in action, even though in here it's talking about the ketubah, therefore it's talking about women. Now, the halacha, how do these things come together? And then we'll come on to our lovely kala. Look at number 10, please. The Rambam rules. These are the following things which a woman breaks Dat Moshe, and here he clarifies as the Gemara asks, and he says, "Your son b'shuk b'tav arosha parur." Fine. She goes out into the shuk, and her hair and her head, two separate things, her hair and her head, are uncovered. That's Dat Moshe. Okay? And the Rambam says that's not just for married women, that's for all women. Look at number 11. Lo yahalchu b'not Yisrael peru'e rosh b'shuk. Women, the Jewish women are not allowed to go, he says, Pru'e Rosh Bashuk, Achad Pnuya, the Achad Eshet Ish. It doesn't matter whether they're single, it doesn't matter whether they are married, the halacha, he says, is the same for both. And it's interesting, we'll see when we get to the Shulchan Aruch how that turns out for unmarried women today. And that basically is ruled in that way by most of the Meforshim. The Rosh I brought you here, I'm not going in here, the Mishnah Berurah rules that it's a Torah mitzvah. There is a minority opinion that the whole mitzvah of head covering in the shuk is a rabbinic mitzvah. I brought you some sources in the bottom. There have been a number of interesting articles written on that, but most of the Achronim clearly rule that it is a Torah mitzvah in the shuk. We'll get on to the single women soon. Yes. In other parts, correct. She's asking here, was the shuk people like by everybody, Jews, non-Jews, etc. And there may be differences between communities. In North Africa or Saudi Arabia or whatever, it may be very different from the way it is in Germany. I would say absolutely that's true when it comes to the Dati Hudit. Meaning whatever is the Dati Hudit in North Africa may not be the Dati Hudit in Germany, and the way women are expected to dress in North Africa, Jewish women, will not be the way they're expected to dress in Germany. But in terms of the Dat Moshe, that should be a, if you like, a line which is for everybody because it's not dependent on the community. Now, one thing which we haven't really looked at, which I want to look at now, is how do we decide on the locations? So if you look in number 14, the Ritva says a very beautiful summary here, very nicely, and he says, Ushlasha dinim d'davar, there are three different dinim on how this works. The b'chatzer, when it's in a chatzer, afilu b'lo kalta ein bo mishum priyas rosh. Even if she's not wearing a kalta, no problem, there's no problem, she's in a chatzer. Private or semi-private. U'b'shuk, in the shuk, afilu b'kalta dati huditi. Even in the shuk, even if she's wearing a kalta, it's not enough, like I said before. U'b'mavoi, and in this sort of between area, an alleyway, kalta in, a kalta is good enough, shaloi b'kalta, but if she's not wearing a kalta, long. And the Ritva makes it very clear that these definitions are not necessarily just geographical or structural. In fact, he says in number 15, yesh, it's a question of fact. You can have a chater which is more like a mavui because there are people running in and out all the time, and you can have a mavui which is much more like a chater because it's very private. There's an alleyway next to the house. No one ever goes there. No one even knows it's there, even though technically it's open to the public. Practically speaking, it's just as private as my chater. He says it really depends on the metzias, on the reality rather than the definition. And therefore, it seems that these three definitions are clear until we get to the issue of Kimchis. Who was Kimchis? And why is she famous? So the Ramah brings up the issue of Kimchis. Look at number 16. He says the only issue of head covering or hair covering is in public. And he says in private, he says there is no issue. But then he says that sneers mi ahava. Maybe there's a private sneers issue in private. Shishum ishaloi tira sara klap. Maybe there are some women who don't want to uncover their heads at all, even in private. Afilu babayit, even in the house. Kamoshim atinu b'mase de kimchis. And he quotes the Gemara in Yuma of Kimchis. Shizachto mishum zeh, that she was zoicha because of this. She got to mimenu konim gedolim. How does the Gemara in Yuma go? I didn't bring you the Gemara inside, but it's a very interesting and again much misquoted Gemara. This woman Kimchis had 7 sons who became Kohanim Gedolim, and the rabbis went up to her and said to her, what is your schus that you had 7 sons who were Kohanim Gedolim? And what did she answer? The roof of my home never saw the hairs of my head. Beautiful. And everyone teaches this, therefore, what do you learn from this? Women aren't allowed to uncover their hair in private. If they want successful sons. Now, the first thing, by the way, that people don't quote is the end of that Gemara. The end of that Gemara, the rabbis turn around to Kimchis and they say to her, lots of other women do this, don't uncover their hair, and they never had sons like yours. Meaning, the rabbis turn around to Kimchis and say to her, no, Kimchis, that's obviously not the answer, because there are lots of other people and it doesn't work for them. So come on, tell us the real answer. That's interesting. People don't ever quote that last part of the Gemara.
Maybe there was no need for her to have a hair in public because of the way she behaved.
Oh.
She wasn't in a position that someone had to come along and say you've done it.
Very interesting. Very interesting. You see, I think you're absolutely right. The Yerushalmi, when it brings the example of Kimchis, actually gives 2 things. It says, she says that my hair was never uncovered and my clothes were never untidy, even in the privacy of her own home. Meaning, Kimchis was a special individual with an incredibly strong sense of personal dignity. For her, uncovering her hair in private might have seemed to be an undignified thing. But the rabbis are saying to her, well, fine, but lots of other women try this, but it doesn't work. Why? Because they're fakers. Meaning, you can't pretend you're a Kimchis when you're not a Kimchis. There's nothing magic in Kimchis. You know, I know people, and I'm sure people have come across this, there are people who will, on some level, have this extreme need to cover their hair, even when they're really not a Kimchis in any way. And I'm not saying it's a problem that they cover their hair, but if you're prepared to go to a mixed beach and wear a swimsuit, but wear a shekel with a swimsuit, and we all know that there are people that do this, okay? Now, I've no problem with the shekel bit of that scenario, okay? Although we'll learn another time whether shekels work at all, but that's a separate question. But how can you be, if you misunderstand Kimchis to the point where you can wear a swimsuit and a shekel on a mixed beach? And there clearly there's been a misunderstanding there. But what's interesting for us is that Darche Moshe has brought this, not as a halacha, but as a private sniyut. If you really are a Kimchis and you want to cover your hair in private too, then that is that's commendable. However, the Zohar we'll see right now brought this into the mainstream. Have a look in the Bach. Look at number 17 through 20, and then we'll move on to the next section. The Bach says the following. Aval la'olam af b'chatzera. Now, what did we say? The Rishonim, the Gemara seem very clear that in the chatzer, there is no reason for her to wear even a kalta, because the chatzer is private or at least semi-private. Aval la'olam af b'chatzera b'lo kalta asur. The Bach comes along and says, actually, I think even in the chatzer, she can't walk around without a kalta on, the pruat rosh legamre. She can't mamash and cover all her hair, even in the chaser. Aval benisharah b'chaserah, davahogan hu, kushem achus b'mitpacha. is that she should wear a mitpacha, some kind of a handkerchief or a snood. Aval pruas harosh legamri, this is in the chaser, pruas rosh completely asur, afilu nishara b'chaserah, even if she's in her chaser, v'hachi nohuk b'chol gvul Yisrael, and he says, this is what we do, all of the Jewish people we know do this, da'afilu b'tnei anshe beta, even in front of her own family, eino shruya b'pruat rosh. She is not, she doesn't walk around with her hair mamash uncovered in front of even her family privately, b'lo mitpacha v'kipa b'roshah. And the Bach in Poland in the 1600s wants us to know that actually, he says that the custom was that women walked around even privately with their hair covered. The Magen Avraham, also in Poland, the same time, says, I disagree. Very interesting. We saw a similar thing when we talked about the mixed seating, right? Remember the Bach turned around and said that men and women never sit together, and the Lavush in Poland said, I disagree. Where we are, the people do sit together. Here, number 18. So the Magen Avraham says, no, dafka b'shuk asur. It's a problem in public. Aval b'chatzah she'ein anashim mitzuyim sham, in the chatzah where people are not normally there, outside people, mutarim lelech b'giloy arash. He says, what's the problem? There is no isur in private. Aval, he says, I'll tell you where people are getting it from. The Zohar in Parshas Nasoi, which is the Parsha of Sota, the Zohar hichmi ma'od, shaloi yirashum, he says, I'll tell you where people are coming from. They're coming from the Zohar. The Zohar goes much further than the Gemara and says, actually, even a private person in a private place with nobody else there should never uncover her hair. The Gemara only mentioned that for kimchis, and even then said, not everybody's a kimchis. The Zohar says, no, that applies across the board, and actually, that is brought by the Mishnah Brura, actually, Bir Halachis. Mr. Brother of the Chofetz Chaim brings that also in number 19, where he says actually the minhag, the Dat Yehudit in our communities, and where's the Chofetz Chaim? He is in Russia in the 19th, early 20th century. He says the Dat Yehudit, let's look at the first line, b'chei megilu imamash afilu b'chedra, even in her own bedroom, asur, she's not allowed to have her head uncovered, Ubala Beit Shmuel, and he brings the Beit Shmuel, which is one of the famous proportion there. Kasav de lefimin hagenu, our menag is havidat yehudit begilu mamash afilu b'chaserah b'chedra. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a big problem with this, and I'm not getting into the psak of Rav Moshe that deals with women's head covering in public, but he says in private, he says this is very strange. Look in number 20. Yam Masha Hichmeh Ha Chasson Sofer, and the Chasson Sofer was very famous, and remember the Chasson Sofer, because we'll meet him again next week when it comes to the bride, okay, when it comes to the Kala. But the Chasson Sofer, he says, when he's Machmir, La Asurum Midat Yehudit, Afilu Bechedra, Balo Mitpachat, says when the Chasson Sofer says, like we've seen in the Mishnah Brura, based on the Zohar, that even in her own bedroom she has to wear something on her head, Behevi Zemeh HaBach of Veishmur, and he brings from the Bach of the Veishmur we've just seen. He says, Rav Moshe, not so fast. Hine, the Bach, when he comes to the Bach, it's a b'chatzira. She wasn't in the cheder, she was in the chaser. B'chol hadibushela, that's what he's talking about there. Shehu makom parut. Ve'ein aderich little rishus likaneisham. Meaning, the Bach only said it in the chaser, she shouldn't have her head mamash uncovered. Because the chaser is fairly, not public, but it's not totally private. V'gam motu sham anshe beisa. And therefore Rav Moshe comes and says, this idea of having to cover your hair in a private home, we never heard about this. We see that everybody agrees that this is acceptable. And he brings various proofs for that, and he ends up at the bottom and he says, Ulachain, Shitacha Chasam Sofer, Bazer Hudavar Tamua. Therefore the Chasam Sofer is very strange when he says that women have to cover their hair in private. Okay, fine. So where does that leave us? We're leaving this topic now. Where does that leave us? Bashuk, it seems very clear that something has to be covered beyond even a kalta. In a private mavoi, in a semi-private, semi-public mavoi, the kalta is enough. In the chaser, there seems to be a debate whether a kalta is or isn't enough. And in the privacy of the woman's own home, it seems that there is a machlokes between the Zohar and the psak of the Gemara, which Rav Moshe is bringing in, which is that the woman has no requirement to do that. Is there a requirement for the woman to cover her hair, even in her own home, even when there are other men there? That's an interesting question. which you could read in different ways based on this. Meaning, when she's on her home, or maybe on her own, or maybe with her immediate family, Rav Moshe says there's no problem here. When she's in her own private home, but there are other men who are not from her family there, so there are different ways that this could be learned in different directions, and that will be relevant for the Kala as well. Now, three subjects which I'm not going to deal with at all now, because they'll take us way off into another tangent. First of all, are the issue of how much hair has to be covered in public. I'm not getting into the tefach, I'm not talking about that now, that's a whole subject in itself, and the whole issue of shekels, both in terms of whether a shekel works to cover hair, can you wear your own hair, can you wear somebody else's hair, real hair, not real hair, the whole hullabaloo that comes up every 20-25 years of the hair made from Indian donations, and everyone realizes that actually somehow or other it's been given to a temple in the Far East, and people decide that it's all avodah zarah and you have to burn your wigs. I remember about 4 or 5 years ago this came up, and I remember driving down to Har Nof and seeing people burning their wigs in the forest. I remember I saw it with my own eyes. I said at the time, only people who are real hotheads can burn their own shekels. But that's a separate topic. I'm not getting into that now. Please go for another time. Let's try and bring it to the Kala. Because I think all of this so far has been important introduction, but introduction nevertheless. When it comes to unmarried women, the Rambam, we said before, seems to say that unmarried women also have to cover their hair. And by the way, there are minhagim with the Sfardim, Rav Avadi would pass him that for davening or for benching, even unmarried women should cover their hair. Even in certain communities in Meisharim, in Geula, the unmarried women don't cover their hair, but they don't walk around with their braids undone. That's based on the Magen Avraham, and if you put this into the Dati Hudit of the young single women there, is that they don't walk away with their hair uncovered. However, the basic halacha is that there is no din of hair covering for unmarried women. Look in number 21. Shulchan Aruch says, Lo telechna benot Yisrael pruvot rosh bashuk, achat pnuya v'achat eshet ish. He just brings the Rambam that says that in public, all Jewish women, married or unmarried, have to cover their hair. However, the Meforshim, pretty much to a man, say, number 22, Echa pnuya, haynu almana o grusha, aval betula mutar. It says, when the Shulchan Aruch said that a woman unmarried woman also has to cover her hair, he's not talking about a betula. A betula is a girl who has never been married. However, a grusha and an almana, that's what he's talking about. A woman who, God forbid, was widowed, a woman who was divorced, she, says the Shulchan Aruch, has to cover her hair, but not a woman who's never been married. By the way, that is in itself a whole topic in and of itself, which is, again, not for now. What is the halacha of hair covering and head covering for a woman who was married but is no longer married, either widowed or divorced? And there are different views on that. Rav Moshe has a famous tshuva where he says that is Das Yehudit rather than Das Moshe, and therefore he makes allowances in different situations if the woman is trying to get married again and she needs to uncover her hair. But that's not for now as well. Let's bring it right to our Kala, because we have 15 minutes and I'd like to now look into the whole Kala issue. Page 5. I'm sorry, it's a bit noisy in here. I can hear lots of noise. I don't know if you can hear okay at the back, but the air conditioning is very noisy. But we'll work it through. Number 23. The Mishnah in Ksuvos says the following. Ha'isha shenit armala o shenit garsha, he omerit betula nisetani, v'hu omer loy, ki ela almana nisiticha. What's nisiticha? What's going on here? There is a woman who was married, and she is now getting divorced, and there is a dispute between her and her husband. She claims that when you married me, I was a betula. I was a virgin, I was a betula, and my ketubah is 200 zuz. And he claims, no, you were not a betula, you were an almana or a grusha, and your ketubah is 100 zuz. So you may ask, well, why don't they just look in the ketubah? This is a scenario where they've lost the ketubah. This is a good reason not to lose the ketubah, but if they did lose the ketubah, they have to somehow work out whether, when this woman was married, was she indeed a betula, or was she an almana or grusha? How are they going to prove that? It's her word against his. Says the Mishnah the following, Im yesh eidim, if they can find witnesses, sheyatza behinuma v'rosha perua, ketubata matayim. can they find witnesses that she, literally, she came out in her hinuma with her hair parua? If they can find witnesses that this is what they did at the wedding, then she was a betula, and it's 200 zuz. What does it mean that she came out in a hinuma with her hair parua? Now, with the benefit of what we've learned so far, we can do this a little bit better. Have a look in number 24. There in the Mishnah Ksuvos, Rashi says the following. Rosha parua. He brings an old French word, which I don't know if your old French is up to scratch. My old French is not so great. He says, ischevelé, which is disheveled. Okay? Meaning she came out with her hair all untied. Like, I don't think it means like a mess, like she just got out of the shower or something like that. If it means that she had long flowing hair, like a kala would have, says Rashi, Sara al Tifer. Her hair on her shoulders, meaning not braided. This is and there's nothing wrong with this. This is how the bride was meant to come out, he says, with her hair over her shoulders. Kach hayu nogim lahotzi et habetulot. And again, this is proof she was a betula, because that is the way they would bring out the betulot. Mi beit avihem lebeit hachatuna. The minhag was that the girl would be brought from her parents' house to the chasna with her hair all over her shoulders. Now, was her hair covered in any way on the top? He doesn't say. He just says it was loose on her shoulders. What is a hinuma? So what is a hinuma? So the Gemara has exactly the same question. Now in modern Hebrew, what is a hinuma? A bridal veil. Okay? So not so quick. Number 25. The Gemara in Ksuba says, my hinuma. Okay, so it says, Sorchov bar papa, mishmeid is the iri ama. So the first view of the Gemara is, tanura da'asa. What's a tanur? An oven made of hadassim. What's an oven made of flowers? We'll see what that is. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, krisa demnamnana bakalta. It's some kind of cover that she's going to go to sleep under. What does that mean? Rashi explains, tanura da'asa, it's kamin chupa shel hadas agula. Some kind of chupa, some kind of canopy. And some people say the hinuma, therefore, according to this opinion, was like a bridal litter, meaning something carried by people, and she's being carried on this beautiful hinuma, all decorated with flowers. And according to the second view, says Rashi, it's a tsa'if. What's a tsa'if? It's a veil, al rosha, on her head, mushulvav aleinah, over her eyes, as we do in our place in France, because we have the bride wears a veil over her eyes. And it's sometimes it happens that she takes a snooze under it. I don't know exactly what weddings were like in France in the 11th century, but it seems that maybe the bride's been up all night, maybe she's very tired, she can take a quick, close her eyes, have a quick nap when no one's looking, because no one can see her face. Because she's going to sleep under her veil. Okay? I can't imagine that most brides these days will sleep under the veil, but you never know. So it's clear from these two opinions that either it's the thing she's carried on, or it's maybe the veil over her face. By the way, there are other opinions that hinuma is from the Greek word hymnos, meaning a hymn, meaning singing and song and celebration. She's taken out with great celebration, etc. But Rashi seems to go with the view that it's either the veil or the litter. Now, what does this say about her hair? Can we see her hair or can't we see her hair, the color? Now, it seems we can see the bottom of her hair, but what about the rest? So look in number 26, the Gemara there in Ksuvos has a whole list of minhagim and halachas that relate to weddings. Arab Shmuel bar Nachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Yonatan, excuse me. Mutzel hisakel bifdei kala kol shiva. Says you are allowed to stare at the kala's face all the week of Sheva Brochas. Why? Why would you be staring at the kala? Kedei lechavav al bala, to make her special to her husband. I would have to work out exactly how this works. What do you? I think basically is people are pointing at her saying, look, that's the kala, you know, whatever, and the husband's going, oh, yeah, Baruch Hashem, you know, I've got a great kala, whatever. But says the Gemara, but that's not the halacha. You can't stare at the kala all through the Sheva Brochas week. So if that's not the halacha, what is the halacha? So look in the Rosh in number 27. The Rosh says, Amara he quotes the Gemara. Amara Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amara Rav Yochanan, Mutali Sakel Bakala Kol Shiva, Kida Lachava Al Barav, Leit Hilchas Akivasi. He brings the Gemara. He says that's quoted, and the Gemara says it's not the halacha. So what is? It says Vayesh Amrim the Kol Shiva Otsa. The whole Sheva Brachas week. That's what's Otsa. Aval Yom Rishon Shehu Ika Hachivuv Etzel Bala Mutar. But on the Yom Rishon, then it is mutar to stare at the Kala. What's the Yom Rishon? The first weekday of the Sheva Brachas, the day of the wedding. He says the Imlo came because if you can't look at the bride, Miyaid, who is going to give this testimony? Shiyatza behinuma v'roshet peruah, meaning somebody is saying we have to bring Adim that she came out with her hair uncovered. If no one's allowed to look at her, who's going to be able to give testimony? So it's clear that somebody's looking at the Kala, and that's when they're looking at her. They're looking somehow at her. Her head, her hair, on that, on her face, on that first day. And that's actually brought down in the Gemara, number 28, in the Shulchan Aruch, excuse me. The Shulchan Aruch rules, Asur lehistakel bakala, you're not allowed to stare in a very, sort of, almost inappropriate way at the kala. Says the Ramah, aval mutar lehistakel betachshitin sha'aleha, you're allowed to look at her beautiful jewelry, or the priyat rosha. And you're allowed to look at her undone hair. And therefore, a lot of the clear understanding coming out of this is that at least some of the Kala's hair is undone. Now, look at number 29. This is the last source we'll see for today, and then we'll start to talk about marriage, and that'll lead us into next week. The Gaonim understood that it wasn't just the bottom of her hair of the Kala which was undone, but it was all of her hair which was undone. Number 29. Barosha Parua. Perush Megula. It was uncovered completely. V'kach hayu nogim lebetula v'lo la'almana. And that's how they would deal with the betula and not with an almana. And that's the whole point of the Mishnah there. If she was previously married to somebody else and she was a widow, they would never have brought her in with her hair uncovered. The fact that she has her hair uncovered means that she was obviously a betula. V'haida amrin ruforis rosha isha. So why does, and when does it say that she has to, in the Sota, that he uncovers her hair, therefore a married woman has to cover her hair? But Tana de Rabbi Yishmael, Mekanja Azhar of Benot Yisrael, who Yashir Lo Yatsa Bapruah Rosh, Lo Yatsu Bapruah Rosh, says the Gaonim, Ikalameima Benesuas Kamairi. Now, what's going on here? You might be asking the question, I don't understand what the big deal is. They're bringing out the Kala, the bride, with her hair uncovered. Why should she not have her hair uncovered? She's not married. Yesterday, the day before that, she also had her hair uncovered. What's the big deal? And the answer is as follows. How did they used to do weddings back in the day, in the time of the Gemara? They used to do the Kiddushin and the Nisuin separately. Today, our minhag is, and we'll talk more about this next week, we'll get into the real understanding of how exactly our weddings work and at what point everything happens. Today we do everything together. We bring in the Kala under the chuppah as an unmarried woman completely. What do we do under the chuppah? We do the Kiddushin, okay? They give her the ring. He says, Hari Amu Kadeshetli, that's the Kiddushin. And now she's a married woman, but she's not yet in a su'ah. And then they do the Sheva Brochas, and they stand on the chuppah, etc. Now she's in a su'ah also, and then they go to the Yichudrin. Back in the day, they didn't do it like that. They did Kiddushin, and then 12 months later they did Nisuin. Therefore, for those 12 months, she was a Mekudeshet. She was living at home in her parents' house, getting ready for the wedding, preparing for the wedding, saving up for the wedding, whatever they needed to do for the wedding. And they brought her as a Mekudeshet, as an Eshet Ish, they brought her to the Chuppah for the Nisuin 12 months later. Now you see what's interesting here. Because this woman who is an Eshet Ish, she is being brought out Barosha Parua with her hair uncovered. And that's the Chiddush. That's what's going on here. Why is it that this woman who is a Kala, not like our Kalas that she's single, but she's already married, she's not completely married, she's still going out according to the Gaonim with her hair completely uncovered. And say the Gaonim only in the sewer has this din of the Sota, as it were, from the, learned from the Sota, that she has to cover her hair completely. And therefore, next time, and I'd like to segue into this by just looking at the last section here, we need to really think about how our weddings work. Really pull them apart. We take a lot for granted when it comes to weddings, but we actually need to look at the details. Our weddings take place today in, I put here, at least 8 stages. It's not just bang, you're married. It's 8 stages. And these have different halachic implications. Let's just look at them briefly, and we'll finish with that. The first stage that we do today is what we call an engagement today, which in modern Hebrew is called an erusin, but really halachically is not an erusin at all. It's more like shiduchim. It's that they've decided to get married to each other. That has no halachic implications at all. They've just basically expressed their intention that they'd like to get married. Stage two, which not everybody does today, is tanaim. And if they do tanaim today, they do it normally just before the chuppah. Tanaim is a financial contract. It doesn't create a marital connection, but it's a financial contract which says that you're going to marry me and I'm going to marry you, and if we don't marry each other, oy va avoy, there'll be big financial problems. Correct. However, breaking tanaim is seen as being extremely problematic, to the point that the Vilna Gaon even says that it's better they should marry and divorce and break the tanaim, which is a very serious business. That's one of the reasons why tanaim are much less practiced now than we never did tanaim before I got married, and my daughter's not doing tanaim, and usually they're just before the chuppah. What's the next thing that happens? Bedekin. What is the bedekin for? We'll see next week. It's not necessarily to see she's the right bride. We'll see. The bedekin may do far more than you think it does. Why do they need Aidim for the Bedekin? If you've noticed, they'll say that they'll get two guys, they'll say, you're the Aidim for the Bedekin. I need to be the Aid. We need Aidim to show that he's checked it's the right bride. It may be the Bedekin does far more than you think. Okay? What goes on next? Then they bring the chosen in, they bring the kala in, he gives her a ring, Hariyam Kudeshitli, the Rav makes the brochas on the Kiddushin. She for sure then is an Arusa, that is Erusin according to everybody's opinion. What do we do next? So we do 4 things, all of which could be the things that create Nisuin. First of all, she stands under a chuppah. What does that do? In some communities, they put a talis over her and him. What does that do? Okay? And they say the Sheva Brachas. Then they go to a yichud room. Although not everybody goes to a yichud room. In the Sfardim, they do not go to a yichud room. Why do the Ashkenazim, yes, go to the yichud room, but the Sfardim don't go to the yichud room? What exactly is the yichud room for? What does it create? And we'll see, we have to understand this because we're asking ourselves, does she have to cover her hair before the yichud, after the yichud, under the chuppah, after the chuppah, etc. The idea of her putting on her shekel for the first time in the yichud room, to me, sounds a bit scary as to this beautiful, stress-free moment of their married life together, and she's putting on a shekel for the first time. Okay. So what does the yichud room do? Then, of course, they have the wedding night. And then, of course, at some point, not necessarily on the wedding night, the marriage is consummated and they have marital relations, and then from that point on there's nothing to argue about at all. But we need to understand in this process, at what point does this hair covering obligation kick in? And therefore, why are there different minhagim, and why is the Jewish community moving more and more these days towards the kala covering her hair under the chuppah, before the chuppah, certain from the yichud room, when that didn't seem to be the case very much until relatively recently in most communities? And therefore, given what we've learned today, I hope, Ezra Hashem, next week that will all make much more sense, and we'll be able to really dissect the whole wedding procedure and understand how it works. So I'll leave you for now, and look forward to next week, please, God.